You are listening to an ADIS podcast.
Welcome to our podcast discussion about COVID-19 vaccination and multiple sclerosis. My name is Dr. Mitzi Joy Williams, and I'm a board-certified neurologist and MS specialist at the Joy Life Wellness MS Center in Atlanta, Georgia. There have been many challenges that we've seen over the past year with the advent of the COVID-19 pandemic. And initially, there were many concerns related to our disease-modifying therapies and risk for COVID-19. But now that vaccination has become more widely available, there are clinical considerations that we want to think about when counseling our patients who need to receive COVID-19 vaccination, but also have multiple sclerosis. I'm very excited to have two wonderful experts here with me today to talk about their experience and to answer some of these questions and hopefully provide some general guidance and discussion around the information we have available. And I will have my colleagues, Dr. Ramahan and Dr. Shin, introduce themselves.
Thank you, Dr. Williams. My name is Dr. Kotil Ramohan. I have been involved with multiple sclerosis ever since I finished my neurology residency in 1976.
I'm Bob Shin. I'm a neurologist at MedStar Georgetown University Hospital. I do MS and neuro-ophthalmology, and I direct the Georgetown MS and Neuroimmunology Center.
Dr. Shin, can you start out by telling us what vaccines are available here in the United States and a little bit about the dosing for those vaccines?
Sure. Well, one thing to remember is that different countries are using different vaccines. In the United States, we have three safe and very effective vaccine options. The first two that we had were Pfizer-BioNTech as a collaboration, and then there's a Moderna vaccine. And both of these vaccines are mRNA vaccines. So they don't use any infectious particles. They just send instructions to help teach the immune system how to fight COVID-19. Then more recently, a third vaccine was added to our toolbox, and that's the Johnson & Johnson Janssen vaccine, which is a different technique using a viral vector. In this case, again, not using COVID-19 in any way, but using an otherwise harmless virus to deliver those instructions. Now, the Pfizer-BioNTech and the Moderna vaccines, the mRNA vaccines, are two jabs, 3 or 4 weeks apart, depending on the vaccine. The J&J vaccine is a one-shot deal.
Dr. Ramahan, any additional thoughts about the mRNA vector, which is a fairly new type of way to deliver vaccines, although it's been around for a long time, but it's new in terms of us being able to use it?
That's exactly correct. The mRNA vaccine has been around in oncology for vaccination against tumor antigens, but as a technique for using against infectious diseases, it's a relatively new technique. The same thing is true also for the adenovirus vector vaccines. What Dr. Shin mentioned, the Janssen, Johnson & Johnson vaccine is an adenovirus vector. The vaccine that is used by pretty much most of the world is the AstraZeneca vaccine that was developed at Oxford, and that's also an adenovirus vector. The other point that I want to make is this is what is called as a subunit vaccine. And what you mean by that is that it doesn't take the whole virus. This is coding just for the spike protein of the virus. Now, the spike protein of the virus itself is two separate peptides with a link point. There is S1, spike protein, and an S2. S1 is the protein with which the virus docks onto its receptor, which is ACE2, which is angiotensin-converting enzyme 2. And that's the receptor that attaches the virus to its host cell. So the strategy used here is that you create antibodies to the S1 domain mainly, and that results in protection, and the virus can no longer dock to its receptor and cause infection. So very effective strategy, just a single part of the virus. You don't give the entire genome like we do in the flu vaccine. This is just a very targeted approach, incredibly effective in its final outcome.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the great things that has come out of the pandemic is that there really has been a lot of amazing science and a lot of collaboration very quickly that we usually aren't able to see. So you mentioned, Dr. Ramahan, the flu vaccine. So just kind of switching gears a little bit, let's think about the recommendations that we give our patients for other vaccinations. We don't have all of the scientific trials about COVID-19 vaccine in people with MS. Obviously, people are developing real-world data sets as we go along, but we still have a long way to go. We think about the flu vaccine. We generally recommend that all of our patients get flu vaccine, regardless as to what treatment they are taking, and really regardless as to the timing. I don't recall going through and talking to my patients and recommending that they pause their flu vaccine or not get their vaccine at certain times because of their treatment. But this is a concern that many people have had, many of our colleagues have had, with the advent of the COVID-19 vaccination, particularly for some of our patients who are taking B-cell therapies. So what are your recommendations, Dr. Shin, for your patients about receiving the flu vaccine? Tell us a little bit about some of the considerations for those receiving COVID-19 vaccine, and what are some of the concerns about receiving those for those who are on anti-B-cell therapy?
Well, I think it's very interesting to go back and think about the good old days when we didn't know about COVID-19 and we didn't have a worldwide pandemic to be afraid of. There had been actually data looking at the effectiveness of things like flu vaccines and other, if you will, routine vaccines in people living with MS who were on a variety of different MS therapies. In general, the study showed either that the MS therapies did not really have much of an effect in terms of suppressing immune response to vaccines, or if there was an effect, it seemed to be relatively modest. And in no case did those kinds of concerns outweigh the mandate, really, to make sure our patients are protected from influenza or any other infection. And so before COVID-19, I'm going to be honest, I didn't really spend a lot of time thinking about it. As you already expressed, I said, get the flu shot. Every year, we would remind our patients to get vaccinated. And I remember earlier in training, I remember a quote-unquote debate where people said, well, I worry that if I stimulate the immune system by administering a vaccine, I might activate their MS. Maybe we should not do that. I think that debate was long ago answered, that there's no evidence that vaccinating our patients with any vaccine is harmful from the MS standpoint. And the benefit of vaccination always greatly outweighed any other potential issues. So that really was my practice before the COVID-19 crisis. And to some degree is still how I'm trying to manage my patients.
Absolutely. And I think, again, I have a very similar practice as we discussed. And then the other question that I'd like to raise for Dr. Ramahan is, when we think about immunity, right, we know that our patients do develop some type of immune response, even though it may be blunted with some of our B-cell therapies. But there also is a T-cell immune response that's important to having protections. So let's say theoretically, if our patients don't develop a good B cell response, if they're depleted, does that necessarily mean they're not protected? Or what does that mean clinically?
That's a very good point. So we know that if a person has congenital A-gamma globulinemia, where they have no B cells, there are case reports of these patients getting COVID-19 infection and making an uneventful recovery. Now, after they recover, if you test their serum for antibody, as would be expected, these people do not have any detectable antibody, but they made a completely uneventful recovery. Some people feared that these people would be at great risk and gave them antibody as part of the treatment. But there are also case reports of people who never received IVIG or immune globulin specific for COVID and made a perfectly complete recovery. And that's sort of been the experience that we went through. In fact, if you recall, in the beginning of the pandemic, in around February, March of 2020, the MS Society put in these recommendations, which was not based on evidence because we simply didn't have any evidence. And the recommendation was really scary for people who are on anti-CD20 therapy, saying be careful. But fortunately, a lot of our MS patients, in fact, most of our MS patients, did quite well and handled the COVID pandemic well. And if you look at covims.org, the registry that captures MS patients that got COVID, as of today, there are probably over 3,200 patients in that registry, but only about 90 deaths occurred, fortunately, and every one of those deaths occurred in people with significant amount of disability. So from the standpoint of the infection itself, not having B cells does not seem to be a significant problem. Now, that said, the opposite is also true, that if you don't have B cells and you got the vaccine, you may not mount an adequate immune response. And there is a lot of debate today as to who will produce antibody in the course of anti-CD20 therapy and who will not produce any antibody. And basically, this may have something to do with the timing of when you give the vaccine in relation to the cycle of when they get their anti-CD20 therapy, or it may have factors that are beyond that. We don't really fully understand it. In fact, there was a very nice presentation at the American Academy of Neurology in a very large number of patients. He found was that after vaccination, patients on ocrelizumab do not mount antibody with the standard Roche platform assay compared to people on other therapies. Highly, highly significant p-value in terms of the fact that people on ocrelizumab did not make antibodies compared to people on other therapies. What was interesting in that same study was these investigators looked at the T-cell response to the vaccine, and majority of people who did not make antibody made a T-cell response. And normally when we test, we do not test for the T-cell part. We only test for the antibody part. And you may walk away thinking that giving immunization to patients on B cell depletion is not worthwhile, but that's not appropriate because these people do have protection. They have the T cell mediated part of the protection.
So that segues and really answers one of the big questions when we talk about guidelines, right? There are a lot of guidelines that have been released and updated every couple months by our different societies, particularly the MS Society, the Federation. And so when we look at these guidelines, they are based on expert opinion, but recommend kind of these ways of timing the vaccine that may not really be feasible in clinical practice. So there's some recommendations that if someone is on anti-B cell therapy, that they wait at least 12 weeks after their last infusion to try to get their vaccine to possibly mount the best immune response. I would say that for my patient population, that I recommend that people get vaccinated when they can get vaccinated. I live in a state where vaccination was very slow and hard to get to at times. And so we didn't necessarily have the luxury of saying, well, we're going to plan on getting your vaccine, you know, 3 months from now or this time from now. And we really have recommended that people get vaccinated as soon as they can with whatever vaccine they can be vaccinated with. So are the recommendations similar for your practices, or do you try to time the vaccination for the best B cell response? We'll start with Dr. Shin.
Well, first of all, let me add something to what Dr. Ramohan had said earlier about summarizing the limited knowledge that we have about vaccination response with MS therapies. I think we should be honest and admit that there's a lot that we don't know about how people benefit from vaccines. We certainly believe that it's a complex process that involves both B and T cells. And I think we should also be honest and say that there have been surprises during the pandemic as we've observed the responses of people living with MS on different therapies in terms of population responses to vaccination. For example, already alluded to, the blunted antibody response that's observed in individuals who are on B-cell therapies, I think was interesting. Part of what was interesting about what was presented was certainly, as pointed out, that T-cell responses can be preserved. But I think also the observation that the antibody titer response varied based on what kind of assay was being used. Some assays were able to identify response and other assays were not. And that's really just looking at B cell therapies in general, where in other contexts, we had already known that antibody titers tend to be depressed in patients on B cell therapies to really any vaccine. And although we've known about this probably for decades at this point, it was never a reason to not vaccinate. We still believe that vaccines benefited patients who were on B-cell therapies. I think a more recent surprise was a small report suggesting that patients on S1P agents had very markedly reduced antibody titers. Whereas previous to this crisis, patients on S1P agents, again, may have had a slightly blunted response, but we still believe that they were still benefiting from the vaccinations. I think a third surprise was that maybe a medication like cladribine, which we believe acts by suppressing B and T cells, was later shown to actually not really affect antibody responses, that the antibody titers were quite robust in patients receiving this. So I think we should just say that there's a lot that we don't know, and it's almost impossible to predict how a patient will respond to a vaccine just based on our limited understanding of the mechanisms of action. We focus on antibody titers because it's something that we can actually measure. Okay. The actual question you asked was on vaccine timing. Early on in the pandemic, especially, there were many different statements that were made by many different individuals that were either published in the literature, on blogs, and they were based on very limited information and often were not consistent with each other's. But I think really the focus is shifting to a different statement with the recommendations, which was that the National MS Society stated that they felt that for individuals, clinical considerations and the mandate to get vaccinated should really take precedence over timing considerations. I'm going to say that in my own personal practice, especially early on when it was more difficult to get the vaccine, my advice was, if you have the opportunity to get vaccinated, please get vaccinated. Even though there's been a little bit more availability, that advice, at least for my patients, still stands.
I agree with everything that's been said. And so switching gears and talking about, you know, some of the anxiety for our patients, there are two more topics that I think we should cover. And one of them being potential side effects of the vaccine, as well as dispelling myths about the vaccine. There are many patients of mine who've received vaccination. I recommend a vaccination, but there's still some who are very concerned about long-term side effects, who are concerned about some of these side effects that we've heard about, such as transverse myelitis. There have been a couple of cases of GBS. And then with the Johnson & Johnson, there were 6 reported cases of blood clotting. These side effects so far are very rare compared to the number of people who've been vaccinated. Looking at the risks versus the benefits, for the majority of our patients, the benefits of being vaccinated would far outweigh the risks. Are there any thoughts that you all have or counseling that you give your patients when they ask about the side effects or long-term efficacy of the vaccine?
You mentioned GBS, Guillain-Barré syndrome, in the trial for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. They had one patient with GBS, but they also found one patient in the placebo arm. Then later, in February of 2021, this year, Pfizer-BioNTech also reported a patient with GBS after the rollout of the vaccine. We really haven't seen cases of GBS pop up here, there, and everywhere. And so this is not a major concern, but it is something that we worried about. You mentioned acute transverse myelitis, and there's a very nice review of this that was published, and they looked at all published acute transverse myelitis. And this was from 21 different countries, 43 cases of acute transverse myelitis from COVID-19 infection, and only 3 from vaccination. And that was during the trial for the AstraZeneca trial that put this vaccine on the market. What is interesting is 1 out of that 3 cases was actually an MS patient who was not previously diagnosed with MS, but when they actually studied the patient, they found that the patient had long-standing evidence of multiple sclerosis, and it was just unmasked during the COVID-19 vaccination in this individual. So is this unmasking of a latent problem due to the vaccination? We don't really know the pathogenesis involved, but as you can imagine, 3 acute transverse myelitis is a tiny number compared to the millions of people who have received this vaccine. There is also this issue of blood clots that you mentioned, 6 cases from the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, but a few additional cases were identified when they put out the bulletin. Bell's palsy has been reported. There was a review about this. The bottom line about all this is whether it's GBS, acute transverse myelitis, blood clots, or Bell's palsy, these are extremely, extremely rare occurrences, and the benefit versus the risks, the benefits far outweigh the risk.
I really try to give a similar message to my patients who are concerned about complications from the vaccine. I think that there is naturally fear whenever anything is new, and so we tend to focus quite a bit on rare side effects. But I think it's also important to emphasize to our patients, what's the alternative? In the United States, 600,000 Americans have died from this virus. It's hard to actually emphasize or accurately talk about how much the risk-benefit ratio tilts in favor of vaccination. I reassure my patients that these vaccines are safe, and whatever potentially small risks there might be are just tremendously outweighed by the benefit to receiving the vaccine. And I think we still have a ways to go in reassuring not just our patients and our peers, but maybe the entire population that there is really no question everybody needs to get vaccinated against COVID-19.
In my experience, it really is all about how I frame it for my patients. I know one of the biggest concerns is the speed at which the vaccine was developed, but I really look at it as a triumph of science. It was kind of a perfect storm where mRNA vaccines had been worked on for a very long time and used in other areas, as Dr. Ramahan stated. I also emphasize the very large number of people who were involved in these clinical trials. 20 and in some cases close to 30,000 people were involved in these trials. And so I really go through the science with my patients, which is reassuring for them. And then I also talk to them about the benefits, you know, of being vaccinated versus getting COVID-19. The other thing to emphasize is not only can it be a deadly disease, for many, it can be a chronic disease. There are people that have very long lasting effects and other sequelae such as heart failure and lung damage. So that shared decision-making is very important. We definitely try to communicate with our patients as much as possible and direct them to trusted sources of information. Some of the big takeaways that I've gotten from this amazing conversation has been that, you know, the COVID-19 vaccination, there are many vaccinations that are offered across the world. The three that we have here in the U.S., the Pfizer, the Moderna, and the J&J vaccine are very safe and very effective for our patients. Certainly, there are some potential side effects, but they're rare. And for most of our patients, the potential benefits of vaccination outweigh the risks of side effects.
I think the emphasis should be go get the vaccine. And I also want to stress that if a patient has previously had COVID, that does not guarantee that they're immune from another attack of COVID. We have seen COVID happened in February and then once again in May in the same patient. And so everybody, including those patients who had COVID previously, should be encouraged to get the vaccine. And then I am more on the conservative side, more conservative than the CDC, I would say, because I tell them, even though you have been fully vaccinated, I want you to still practice social distancing, hand washing, and mask. Because you hear about variants that might break through. Until this pandemic is over, practice good prophylaxis.
The only thing that I might want to add is when it comes to our MS treatment options and questions about whether we should delay treatment or perhaps avoid initiating certain treatments or switch people from one treatment to another out of concerns about vaccine efficacy, I would emphasize that we already have known risks of undertreating MS, which is that if we either delay treatment or use less effective therapies in patients with active disease, those decisions will result in more relapses, more MRI lesions, and more disability over time. All evidence so far has suggested that all of our MS patients benefit from vaccination, regardless of what MS therapy they're on. And therefore, at least in my opinion, we should continue to stay the course in terms of remembering our primary mission of reducing the impact of MS on our population.
Absolutely. And we recommend our patients continue to protect themselves. We know what MS does, and we need to treat MS and making sure that our patients remain free of as much disability as possible and also protecting them against COVID-19.
You are listening to an ADIS podcast. You can listen to more podcasts by subscribing to ADIS Podcast with your preferred podcast provider or by visiting the journal website. For a full list of declarations, including funding and author disclosure statements, please read the article on the journal website.